Sorry, Chairperson.
Honorable Sheikh Imam.
Sorry, good morning to you and all the honorable members. I'm moonlighting at the moment between police and the chief works meeting at 10 o'clock. So I'm in and out. But thank you, sir. My apologies.
We'll note that, honorable Sheikh Imam. Thank you very much.
Yep.
Yes, let's see. Okay, this is a straightforward one, honourable members. Will presentation by National Treasurer will start with Ms. Maddie Jane on the Division of Revenue Bill, and then Dr. Mampo will follow after that. Thank you. Let's see. You know how we do it. Ms. Mary Jane, please come in the presentation.
Good morning, everyone. You can see I look a bit different than Ms. Mary Jane. Jane is dealing with her family bereavement, and I'm the acting DDG IGR for the next week or so. I'll be standing in for her, and please accept her apologies that she cannot attend today. Can I please ask my team to put up the presentation?
Wendy, it's noted. Our condolences to Maddie Jane. Please convey our condolences to her. I know we're in good hands. Please take us through your presentation.
Thank you so much. Again, what we will be doing is we'll be doing a round robin. I'll do some parts of the presentation, then Bongani Dalka will be taking you through the provincial side of the presentation, and Dr. Lesepa Pakis will be taking you through the local government side of the presentation. So thanks for that. So if you can, what we'll do is we'll take you through the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill. If you can go to the next slide, please. What we'll be doing is, I've already indicated that we'll take you through the provincial allocations, the local government allocations, but we'll give an overview of the Division of Revenue Bill as well, and also changes to the bill clauses and schedules. And we'll take you through the primary ones that's important for the committee to note. There's also additional information, and we can present it to the committee if there's a request. We do, as part of the Division of Revenue Bill, it's a very thick document, over 300 pages. We do indicate the responses to the FFC recommendations that directly relate and indirectly relate to the Division of Revenue for the next year, and many of those recommendations dealt with the need for changes to conditional grants, and we're fully in support of those recommendations, and we've actually got a process currently underway where we're actually dealing with those issues. We're doing a complete overall review of the conditional grant system, all conditional grants on the local government side, on the provincial side, and we're looking how we can deal with various issues that's raised there, and we can give more information on the work that we're doing there as well. But it's looking at all the concerns that a lot of stakeholders have raised, for example, the conditionalities, the number of conditional grants, the issue about direct and indirect grants, whether things should be funded through a conditional grant or through the equitable share. So we're doing really quite a big, extensive overall. So it will take a number of years to do. But every year we'll be introducing some of the changes, and we'll indicate to the committee those changes as part of the MTPPS to indicate what changes will be introduced for the next year. And then we've also, as part of the budget review, there's an Annexure A that we've also comprehensively dealt with all the recommendations that come from this committee and also the Select Committee on Appropriations. Thanks. Next slide. Next slide. Okay, what this slide indicates is, you know, how the national and provincial and local government fiscal frameworks fit together. And then also to indicate what has happened to the allocations. Transfers to provinces increase with an average of 2.8%, where conditional grants growing faster than equitable share. And I'll get to a bit more detail there. And then transfers to local governments grow at a higher rate, 7.4%. And particularly important there, and Dr. Puckett will take you through in quite a bit of detail there, why that increase is so high. And I'm sure some of you can already guess that it's got something to do with the ESCOM bulk increase that's happened. If people can recall last year, and Bongani can touch on that a bit, last year, this year, we are making quite a bit of injection into the equitable share as well, although it's smaller than the conditional grants, to put provinces in a better position again to deal with particular pressures in health and education. But like I indicated, Bongani will take you through in more detail. And then if you can then look at the bottom part of this graph, it indicates the shares that's allocated to national provinces and local governments. And as you can see, national for 2022-23, their share was 50%. And it is going down, let's just go back to the previous slide, it's going down to 49%. And at the end of the MTF, it's 48.3%. If you look at provinces, the current share is 40.9%. Over the MTF period, it goes up. It grows up to 41.6%. And then local government is currently 8.7%. And over the MTF, it goes to 10.1%. And it is, to some extent, the rebalancing back to how it used to be quite a number of years ago. Because in the past, as we're all aware, there were quite a few pressures on SOCs. There's also other additional expenditures on national, such as SRD and the like, and that has increased the national share in the past. Next slide. Okay, what this slide indicates, and we reflect on it every year, and let me start with the provincial allocations. There's always a concern that, are the allocations that's going to provinces equitable? Are the allocations that's going to local government equitable? And what we're looking here is its ability, of provinces and municipalities to generate their own revenue to deal with the cost pressures that's faced by them. And if you look, for example, on the provincial side, Gauteng is, for example, the largest population in terms of population numbers, but we do know that a lot of people in Gauteng, for example, access, services such as health, such as schools through the private sector rather than the public sector. So what the provincial equitable share does is look at how many people in the province access public services. And then the shares are allocated accordingly. So for example, Gauteng's share, if you compare to Eastern Cape, for example, where many more people use public facilities in terms of health, their share is much larger, although their population, for example, is much smaller than Gauteng. And the same applies to the municipalities. You can see the small towns per share per household is much, much bigger than that for the metro. And it's an acknowledgement that metros can raise substantial own revenues where smaller towns and rural municipalities cannot do so. So there is a lot of redistribution in the formula. Of course, we can always look at improving the system, and we're always reviewing the system to try to make it even more equitable, but the system so far is equitable. Next slide. If I can then hand over to Bongani Dalfa, that will be taking you through the provincial allocation. Thanks.
Okay, thanks Wendy. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members, and good morning, colleagues. My name is Bongani Daka, and I'll be taking you through the provincial government allocation. Please go to the next slide. So in In terms of the provincial transfers, what we are indicating that for the first year of the 2023 MTEF, which is 2023-24,
the recording in progress.
Provinces have been allocated 695 billion, of which the equitable share is 667 billion, and the conditional grants are 128 billion. And then we are indicating that for the 2023, about 97% of the transfers or budget of the provinces will be from transfers, and roughly about 3% will be from own revenue. And what we are also indicating is that the equitable share is growing at an annual rate of 2.5, while the conditional grants are growing at an average annual average rate of 4.3%. And there have been substantial additions that have been made to provincial fiscal framework. And just to indicate, over the 2023 MTEF, about 92.7 billion has been added. And this addition is made up of 76.9 billion, which is added to the provincial equitable share, which I will take the committee and members through. And 15.8 billion is added to conditional grants, which will also indicate to which specific conditional grants that money has been added to. And these funds mainly that have been added are to respond to the current spending pressures that exist in the system. And also there were projects that have been approved through the budget facility for infrastructure. And due to the disasters that are occurring, there is also additional funding that has been made available for the repairs and the rehabilitation of that infrastructure that has been damaged. Please go to the next slide. Here, what we are showing annually, we have to do the technical updates to the provincial equitable share. And the box on the right is showing the six components, and there are percentages which those that sort of take most of the funding are education with 48% and health with 27%. But then the table on the left, we are showing the data that has been used to update the provincial equitable share formula for the 2023 MTEF. And then for each component whereby there is population data that has been used, we updated using the latest, which is the 2022 mid-year population. And however, there are some where data is still sort of stuck in the past. As an example, it will be in the case, for example, for the GDP per region. This is because the latest data that is available for that is the 2029 data. Currently, status indicated that they are busy kind of looking at the series, and they are going to use a new methodology of measuring this. So now that is why they are no longer producing such data. And even when one is looking at the health component as an example, we updated using when one is looking at the risk-adjusted factor. When we are looking at the medical aid schemes, people with medical aids, we updated using the latest available data, which is 2020-21. However, as for the updating of the general household survey is the 2018. And the reason for that is because recently we reviewed the risk-adjusted index within the health component. And when we're doing that, we're looking at the factors. And these factors, for example, they will be looking at the cost of, let's say, cost of getting medical service for a male 20 years and all that. So this data does not necessarily have to be updated annually. because it does not change that much from year to year, but it will be updated periodically. So within this risk-adjusted factor, there is data that we will update annually, but some data will be updated periodically. So the fact that we're still using the 2018 General Household Survey is just because from year to year, like the cost of getting a medicine for a specific person with a specified demographic does not necessarily change that much. And even previously, we had an issue with the patient load data, whereby this, like we look at the number of patients that are visiting healthcare centers. And previously, we used the old data because of COVID, given that during COVID, people were not necessarily using the, were not visiting the health centers. But it seems now the sort of the data is somehow going towards what or recovering from like what was happening during COVID. So we used the latest available data for the 2019-20 and 2021. Please, we can move on to the next slide. So here I'll be taking honorable members through the changes that have been made to the provincial equitable share. As I indicated, additions that are made to the provincial equitable share are in the tune of 76.9 billion. So this is the 76.9 billion that I will be talking to. So to deal with the COE pressures within the education sector, 20 billion has been added over the MTEF. Even in previous years, there have been additional funding that has been made available to ensure that teachers are being paid and they are able to teach, they are present in their classes. And then also to deal with the health sector backlogs, and some are as a result of COVID, as it was indicated that there have been backlogs that were created. 23.7 billion has been added over the MTEF, and this is to deal with the antiretroviral treatment, TB backlogs, the health service backlogs, COE pressures, among others, and the buying of goods, medical goods and services. And then the other addition that was made as a result of the implementation of the 2022 wage, additional funding was made over the 2023 MTEF for the carry-through costs. And this addition is to the tune of 31.1 billion. And this funding has been, the way that it has been allocated through to provinces is using the provincial equitable share formula. And then in terms of to respond to the arrears in the compensation of ISIN donors in the KwaZulu-Natal province, 631 million is added only for the first year of the MTEF, the 2023-24. And then as indicated that there was other funding that has been added or approved through the budget facility for infrastructure. The Kuga SEZ in the Eastern Cape will be getting an amount of 1.8 billion over the MTEF. And this is to deal with the water infrastructure that is within the SEZ. So the SEZ can have the capacity to deal with the expansion that is happening. Please go to the next slide. In terms of the additions that have been made to the provincial conditional grants, as indicated, the additions amount to 15.8 billion. When we are breaking them down per sector, when we are looking at the education sector, 1.6 billion has been added to the ECD. And this is to increase the number of children that will be accessing the ECD subsidy, and also to provide for the pre-registration support. And also there is going to be a pilot in terms of the nutrition support program and the result-based service. So in terms of the funding that has been added, the funding is added for the two outer years of the MTEF. In the first year of the MTEF, the addition has been to the national department, And in terms of the detail of that, that will be presented in the appropriations bill. And then in terms of the additions to the National School Nutrition Program, 1.5 billion is added over the MTEF, and this is to ensure that the meals that are being provided to almost 9 million learners kind of meet the nutritional requirements. And also for the education infrastructure grant for Gauteng, there is funding that was approved through the budget facility for infrastructure, and this is it to the tune of 1.5 billion. So this is this will strictly be going to the Gauteng for the Gauteng school program. And then there is also 3 million that is added in the 23-24, and this is to deal with the carry through cost of the disaster that happened in April 2022 for KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape. And then when we look at the transport sector, there is funding that has been added, given that there has been previously comments in terms of the state of the provincial roads, 6.8 billion has been added to deal with the refurbishment of the bedrock in terms of the provincial roads. And then further to that, during the adjustment budget, there was funding that was added for the building of the rural bridges. But during the adjustment budget, it was only added to for two provinces. And during that time, we indicated that in the 2023 budget, we are going to add more money and more provinces will be getting the funding for that. So in terms of that building of the rural bridges to ensure that communities are able to move and access services, 3.7 billion has been added. And then this money will be used under the Welisizwe Rural Bridge Program. Please move to the next slide. When we now go to the agriculture sector, also this funding has been added through the budget facility for infrastructure, and the money is going to flow through the comprehensive agricultural support program. And this funding has been approved for the KwaZulu-Natal Agri-Hubs. So the amount that will be added for this is 153 million. So this amount is added over the MTEF. So, and as honorable members can see that in the first year it's 8 million, and then in the two outer years it's 86 and 58 million respectively. And then when we are looking at the health sector, previously through the budget facility for infrastructure, funding was approved for the Limpopo Academic Hospital or the Limpopo Central Hospital. And what we are showing here is that the funding is being rescheduled just so that it aligns with the needs of the project in terms of the financial needs. So, but however, this does not mean that the money is being taken away, because in the first year, the money is reduced so that it aligns with the cash flows. But in the outer 2 years, the funding has been increased from like the initial amounts that were indicated for those financial years. And then when we move to the human settlements sector, the provincial emergency housing grant from the 23-24 financial year will cease to exist. This is because the funds are being shifted to the National Department of Human Settlements, so that that will allow for flexibility and for them to respond quickly to any housing emergencies that will emerge. Next slide, please. And honorable members, also this week we have been having meetings with the National Department of Health. And they have, although this is not included in our presentation, because we were required to submit our presentation in advance, which we which we completed and did, but this came after because these were meetings that happened this week. The Department of the National Department of Health indicated that they are dealing with the measles outbreak because in some provinces there are such cases. And then what we are requesting from the committee is that we are humbly requesting that the committee allows us in one of the direct health conditional grants to allow for funding to be used for the administration of the measles vaccine. The reason being that by the time we concluded the budget, those discussions had not happened by then, but we are aware that there might be a need for that over the MTEF. And one of the grants currently that, although we have not yet agreed on the final wording of the condition to be included, but one of the grants that we currently have identified for the possibility of that to happen is the District Health Program grant. And within that grant, there are programs which are already provided with funding. And if any province wants to use that money for the administration of the measles vaccine, they will have to get permission from the National Department of Health, because any movement of funding between the programs has to be approved by the National Department of Health. So the department will have to do the due diligence to ensure that the funding that is being moved for the administration of the measles vaccine, sort of that is done correctly, and then it's going to be used as required. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson, Honorable Members and colleagues. I'll hand over to my colleague, Lizzie Papakis, to take you through the presentation. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members and colleagues at large. I will be taking the next five slides pertaining to the local government allocation. So if we can just go to the first slide, please. Here, Honorable Members, with an appreciation of what has already been said by the acting Atiriji regarding the transfers to local government, where she indicated that the share of local government from national raised revenue is currently sitting at 10%. Appreciating also, though, that the local government sphere is one sphere that has the power to raise its own revenues from other sources of revenue, like electricity, water, just as an example. So my table here really is showing all the transfers, conditional and unconditional, that flow from the national fiscals to then assist municipalities in meeting their constitutional obligations. So in a nutshell, Honorable Members, over the 2023 MTF, we really see allocations that go to local government increase by a total of 14.3 billion. And in the main, the largest increases are in the equitable share, where 8.1 billion has been added. There is also 6.2 billion that has been added to the direct conditional grant. So these, my next slides will be getting into the details of what it is that is being funded from those additional funds. But it's suffice to say, this takes the total direct allocations to local government to 521.7 billion over the MTF. This is quite important, Honorable Members, because these allocations help alleviate some of the financial pressures that municipalities are experiencing, in particular when it comes to the provision of basic services as the costs are continuing to increase. So these allocations coupled with some efficiencies from the municipal side should be in a position to assist municipalities really do more than what they currently are doing. Just to zoom in to maybe specific allocations, we see the equitable share there growing at an average annual rate of 8.1%, owing to the additional funding that has been provided them. If we can move to the next slide. In this slide, honorable members, we are showing the components, firstly, of the equitable share. So this is the allocation that flows to all our 557 municipalities. And that is where the additional resources have been added. So perhaps the question you might be asking yourselves now is what informed the amount that was added into the formula? And here is our story really. One of the variables that inform the allocation to local government is the household growth. So the household growth has been 2.7%. So this is the data that we received from Statistics through the general household survey that they then conduct. So we have updated the formula to factor that in. And secondly, we also, when it comes to the costing for water, we use the average water board about price increases, and here we've got 8.9%, which we also compensated for in the formula. Now here, honorable members, I think something that concerns every South African is around the pricing for electricity. You would be aware that Eskom and NERSA, through the process, you know, of determining the bulk electricity tariffs, that the result in there has been that, you know, there's an 18.7% increase in terms of the bulk electricity. So what we have then done through our processes really is to then taking into account that Eskom is yet to determine how much each of its customers. So this 18.7 is really for all its customers, but it still needs to determine how much it's going to be charging municipalities and the various other customers. And with that in mind, and knowing that it has 9 months to recoup this 18.7 from the municipalities, we then added 2%, because usually what happens is that final determination is usually around is usually up or more by 2%. So we've added that into the formula to ensure that we fully subsidize the provision of basic electricity. And then when it comes to other costs, really, like your refuse removal as well as sanitation, we've used the CPI projections there. So these, I think these variables, or the changes to these variables have really informed the amount of additional resources that have been added. However, honorable members, I will perhaps at this point also want to touch on that whilst we have fully funded for all the 11.2 million households that we have in the country, we've also created a buffer for ourselves as government. In case there are any approvals from the bulk electricity, specifically for municipalities, that is over and above this 20%, which is already above the 18.7%. So there's an amount that is within this 8.1 billion that we've added, which we have left unallocated, which we're going to come to you in the time of the adjustments budget when all is clear, because by that time, Eskom would have made the final determination in terms of the costing. And then we are going to be meeting with the various stakeholders to decide on how we are going to address those issues. But the first point of call really will be any of the, you know, implications of that tariff increase for municipalities. And of course, we will have an opportunity to also look at some of the, you know, issues facing local government, some cost pressures there, which are not recurrent in nature, because it's important that because this amount, you know, we shouldn't create a need going forward. So we should address the current issues in the best way possible. And so for the package then that we are coming up with in terms of the free basic services, so we are now in a position to subsidize all the 1102 plus households per month with an amount of 528.29 cents there in the 2023-2024 financial year, which is then going to assist our poor households just to have the basic necessities. And of course, you know, this is over and above what is being done at the national government level in terms of the SRD grant. We also have healthy growth on our members in terms of the institutional and the community services component. And those two components are the ones that Wendy would have spoken to earlier on when you spoke about how redistributive the division of revenue is, because those are the two components that are specifically targeted at our small and poor and rural and municipalities to help them just have the basic administration in place, but also to fund some of the community services funds in there. So if we can move to the next slide. In this slide then, honorable members, really starting to zoom into how much was added in each year in which component of funds really for local government. So I've spoken to the 8.1 billion that is added to the equitable share. So in this first bullet, really, we are showing that in each of these three MTF years, that how much has been added. So in the first year, it's the 2.5 billion. There's the 2.3 in the middle year, and then there's the 3.3 billion in the outer year. And again, I must stress, honorable members, that these ensure that we are fully funded in the provision of free basic services, because our formula is such that it's a bottom-up model. So we cost and then ensure that each year we then update the costing to ensure that we do not really leave municipalities in terms of their own, in terms of dealing with the free basic services. We've also made other adjustments, honorable members, similar to what Bongani has spoken about. So in terms of the discontinuation of the municipal emergency grant, so that grant doesn't exist, at least through the division of revenue, because of the challenges that we experienced there, the department will be doing that from its vote. So municipalities will be encouraged to directly liaise with the department in terms of the issues that emerge there. But the department is also actively beefing its capacity as well to be able to be proactive in dealing with the issues of emergency housing. In the public transport network grant, this grant, honorable members, you will recall, in the past, we have had some issues with poor spending. So there was really a space for some reprioritization to take place there. So 8 million in the middle year and then the 13 million in the outer year have been reprioritized for this grant to really assist us with the rollout of the single integrated ticketing system. This system, honorable members, helps us to integrate all the modes of transportation, something that will also benefit the local government. So we're quite excited to assist with that one. Moving on to the next slide. The next slide, honorable members, really looks at some of the BFI rescheduling. So this is the budget facility for infrastructure. So in the past, they would have come to you, honorable members, asking that we amend these grants based on the cash flow of these municipalities. So in the past, specifically to the city of Cape Town's My City Public Transport Project, we had asked that, you know, we reschedule some of those. So we reduce the allocation and we'll be bringing it back at a later stage when the municipality has really procured the necessary systems and capacity to be able to roll it out. And I'm able to say that has taken place, and hence we are coming here now. We are bringing more the money that we had rescheduled into the system so that the municipality can implement this project based on the implementation plan and the cash flow projections that we're currently working with. And then in terms of the George, so George municipality is one of the municipalities that got funding from the fifth window of the BFI. However, at that time, I think there was optimism in terms of the capacity that was there. So they had then, I think since then, had lost, you know, the infrastructure manager and some in the CFO's office also had left the municipality, which has then opened the space for us to then relook at the capacity that is there and then reduce the allocations. But I know they have since gotten the those posts advertised, and we're hoping that in the near future we'll be bringing back the money into the system, because it's important that those projects that have already been started are finished. So we are reducing 136 million there in the first year, and then we are adding a bit in terms of the 1.4 million in the middle year there. So we are really trying to get them going and getting the necessary assistance that they would deserve into that space. In terms of the next slide, please. So this slide, it is my last slide, honorable members. It is looking at the new window now. So what we're dealing with was the window 5. So there was a new window that was instituted, and municipalities applied, and we are really happy that, you know, 5 of 4 municipalities really got some funding from the window, from window 6. So here we're talking about a Tekwini Metro, which has been allocated 206 million in the first 2 years of the MTF. And what this money is really going to help us with is I think is the sector, you know, it will help provide the municipal services, you know, that will enable the private sector housing and manufacturing and really just some of the industrial park developments in the space. So what BFI is assisting with really here is also bringing in the private sector resources and expertise, something that we really are the part infrastructure rollout. So being able to bring in the private sector, the infrastructure front is also involved in assisting us bring some blended financing into the space so that we can lessen the burden on the fiscal side. So that is what is happening there. And of course, we are adding a 2 billion rand really to the city of Johannesburg. And also here, it is for infrastructure, municipal infrastructure. That will also enable the development of, I think it's about 300 housing units. Development and again, yeah, you know, we are using the municipalities' functions. Municipalities is providing its functions in really strategic areas that is bringing in the private sector resources, helping us to tackle some of these other pressing issues that our communities are facing. In terms of the allocations that go to SOLPLAC, it's about 1.2 billion. This is for really urgent refurbishment and renewal of old water supply infrastructure, which is actually in a current poor state. I mean, we are aware that our municipalities are really struggling with maintenance of their infrastructure and to prevent issues of collapse, you know, which would lead to massive health issues. So this facility has assisted us in helping this municipality deal with that through these additional resources. And again, Drankenstein municipality will also be receiving 1.2 billion dens, which will help it upgrade, you know, the wastewater treatment plant, as well as some of the bulk sewers, you know. So this is really help accommodate the current demand that the municipality is facing, but also it helps cater for the future new development and demand, because Drankenstein is one of those, we call it ICMs, you know, so they're one of those really growing municipalities that have potential for spatial, you know, development at a scale that would benefit the country as a whole. And then lastly, honorable members, there is an amount allocated. I mean, the honorable members would be aware of the issues that that Etrabeja is facing. So there's 988 million that is added over the MTF to assist the Nelson Mandela Bay Metro municipality there to avert some of these water supply crises. We are aware that the drought, the ongoing drought there is really crippling the municipal coffers. So there's additional resources that come with the expertise also to speedily deal with the issue that has been allocated there. So we are hoping that this program would this funding would really focus on the immediate water supply challenges in that metro and help that municipality be able to avert what many call the day zero that is coming in that space. Honorable members, that sums up my part of the presentation, and thanks for your time. I will now hand over to Wendy.
So thank you so much. This is the last part of the presentation, and what I'll be taking you through is the clauses to the Division of Revenue Bill. And if you can just go back, we've jumped a number of slides. If you can go to slide 19, please, that will be appreciated. It deals with... you know, we do not highlight to the committee, you know, some of the small minor technical changes just to improve some of the wording of the legislation. What we generally focus on are the policy changes to the Division of Revenue Bill. This year we've got quite a few, and I'll take you through them. Firstly, we've made changes to Section 5, and I'll later on refer to them as well because it links to a number of clauses. Currently, the only grant, be it conditional grant, be it equitable share, where the actual date for the payment of that grant is stipulated in the Division of Revenue Act is the local government equitable share. All the other grants are determined in terms of a payment schedule that's approved by the National Treasury, but done in collaboration with the National Transferring Officer. But to give certainty to municipalities to get their equitable share, given that there's only three tranches, those dates are then stipulated and have been stipulated in the Annual Division of Revenue Act for the last few years. But as committee members are aware, sometimes municipalities do not do credible budgets. They do not pay their ESCOMs. They do not pay their water boards for a number of years, which results in you know, some interventions required. So in the past, the National Treasury has delayed the transfers to some of those municipalities to enable some reformative behavior and action to result in more credible budgets, to result in them agreeing to payment schedules with ESCOM and the water board concerned. And that means we did not pay the equitable share on the stipulated date, but at a later date. So just to fix the legal loophole, what is then added is the section, subsection 3 is amended to allow that the date may be different if it's stopped in terms of section 2162 of the Constitution. So for municipalities that do not fall subject to that, they will still get the equitable share on the normal date. Then another change that's made, and it is not a new change, it's now the second time it's been introduced as part of the 2022 Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, we presented to the committee additional provisions to the Division of Revenue Act to allow for provincial conditional grant pledging. Just to indicate to the committee, this will now be a standing feature in future and this Division of Revenue Act. So it will become a permanent provision. This provision has not been used to date, but we do expect in time to see some of these requests coming through and resulting in actual approvals being granted. Then with regard to Section 13, it is, again, just to ensure improved oversight. In the past, what happened is everyone did receive draft reports of infrastructure programs, but they did not receive the final report. So this is just to strengthen that provision to ensure that everyone also gets the final report so that they can enhance and improve their oversight. Then another provision that's been made, and as committee members are very, very aware, what happens, I'm going to give an example because it always gives a bit of substance to why this is needed. We know that we've got human settlements grants in the system. So what happens is that funds are unspent, just before the end of the financial year. So what a province or a municipality will do is they will take that money and transfer it, for example, to the national institution that's at the Department of Human Settlements, HDA, and then the funds are recorded as spent, but it's not really been spent. So this is just an additional provision to ensure that that type of behavior is not continued, because then funds can also remain unspent at that organ of state. And then over time, the money disappears in the system. So it's also just for improved oversight that we get, the necessary controls applied to that money as well, and not for them to circumvent the system. Next slide, please. Okay, and then with regard to, and I'm sure the provincial legislatures will be very happy to hear this one, because what happens in the past, we do get requests very, very late from national departments requesting that funds be stopped to this province or this municipality and then be allocated to another province or municipality to ensure improved expenditure. And it happened in the past that provincial legislatures need to sit on the day or just the day before the end of a financial year to result in those monies actually being recorded in the books of the provinces, for example. And we've just added deadlines now that, we get submissions earlier and after a certain date, those requests are not processed anymore. That is also to bring a bit more, control in the system as well. Then with regard to Section 2022 payment requirements, it links also to the already, what I already presented in terms of Section 5. This is just a similar link to ensure that those amounts are amended then to allow for the delayed expenditure. And then the last change that's policy in nature is, we do know that, there's court action taken before all the intergovernmental relation processes have been concluded. So there's just a new requirement that if one organ of state decides to take, judicial proceedings against another organ of state, it must just advise us 10 working days before that is done. The National Treasury, the relevant provincial treasury, the Department of Cooperative Governance, and the Auditor General. Then we also want to see to what extent they've tried to, do the intergovernmental processes as per the required legislation. So this is also just to try to avoid unnecessary legal action between organs of state. Then the last slide that I'm going to present is, and it's already been presented by my colleagues, this is just to indicate, although the emergency housing grants don't exist anymore, it does exist on the books of the National Department of Human Settlements, And there's a very specific reason why they ask for it. It is to ensure that, for example, when there's a housing emergency, that quicker response can be taken because there can be central procurement of, for example, of temporary housing facilities and the like, and to give them more control over the process. And that is the end of our presentation. Thank you very much for listening to us. Thanks.
Thank you, Wendy, and your team on the Division of Revenue, Bill. I think let's go straight to Dr. Mampo, second adjustment.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honorable members. Thank you, Chair, for one, taking the time to allow us to do the presentation for the second bill. I think what we want as the Treasury is to try and process this bill as quickly as possible. So thank you so much for taking the time. I'm just going to share my screen quickly. Thank you, Chair. So basically what we are presenting today is the second adjustment appropriation bill. And Chairperson, this is just a slide that gives the members of the committee the sections in the PFMA that allows the minister to table the adjustments budget. We have had questions when we were doing the presentations or when we're tabling the budget on what justifies Treasury to table the second adjustments bill, but the PFMA does allow for us to do so. So section 30, subsection 2, states that these are some of the activities that may result in the minister tabling or that provide for the tabling of the second adjustments appropriation bill. So basically what we are coming here for, honorable members and chairperson, is we coming here to present money that is appropriated for expenditure that was already announced by the Minister of Finance when tabling the budget, and this was the compensation of employees as well as funding for the land bank. But what we also did, Chairperson and honorable members, we then shifted funds between votes so that we could use some of the potential underspending in other votes to bring this to the votes that were pressed for funding. I mean, of course, there's other areas where you can bring in second adjustments for Section 16 of the PFMA, for unforeseen and unavoidable, for the rollover process, but this is not what we took into consideration. So from the list of what we can bring for an adjustment, the two sections that we are looking at are the ones that are highlighted in red that I will go through. Then the second question, Chairperson and honorable members, that is there, is why the urgency of this bill. So basically, Chairperson and honorable members, we require the departments that are proposed for funding to use the funding by the 31st of May, and the date for the 31st of May is because this is the date where the financial statements for the year 2022-23 must be finalized. So this transaction falls within the 2022-2023 fiscal year. So we're using the resources that already exist in the system. If honorable members and chairperson, we were including these monies for the following financial year, which is 23-24, then of course there wouldn't be the urgency of this bill, and we would have included these allocations in the normal appropriation bill that was also tabled by the minister. So this is to make sure that we at least have the department spend this money before the financial year end, or before they finalize their financial statements, which is the 31st of May. So basically by the 31st of May, the bill must have been passed by Parliament assented by the president and also published in the Gazette, and the departments would have withdrawn the funds before the 31st of May. So this is just the background on why the agency of this bill. So, Honourable Members and Chairperson, the second adjustment appropriation bill has basically five transactions that we're bringing to your attention. The first one, or the group of them, would be allocations to different state-owned companies, South African Airways, the South African Post Office, the Land Bank, and we also bring into your attention the additional amount that was allocated for political party funds, as well as the 2022-23 public service wage increase that was implemented. So just going into the details, Chairperson and Honourable Members, just quickly, after the implementation of the 3% by government, the adjustments had to be made to the different departments who were not going to be able to absorb the cost of living adjustment within their existing budget. So what we did here, Honourable Members, we're just showing you, according to the department that received the largest funding, which would be police at 1.891 billion, and then the Defence Force was allocated 800 million and going down to up to the National School of Government. So most of the departments were given additional funding to deal with the wage pressures. The two departments that, the one department that was not allocated funding was additional funding was the National Treasury, because they could absorb the increase within their existing baseline. But for the rest of the departments, or for most of the departments, we had to allocate additional funding to help them deal with the increases in the wages. Then Chairperson, Cabinet made a decision that to finally exit the business rescue process of South African Airways, we had to provide additional funding of 1 billion, and this is basically allocated to assist with historical debt that is still outstanding. But of course, we have conditions that are attached to this transaction, and these conditions basically are just to make sure that the state doesn't go back to fund SAA. So basically the three, four conditions, of course, there's other operational conditions that are there, but I think the key four conditions that we have is that all government guarantees to SAA will be cancelled. There'll be no more guarantees to this. And Takaso needs to provide proof of funds for the strategic equity partner transaction. And then also the National Treasury will then review the strategic equity partner agreement just to make sure it does not give rise to future fiscal obligations. So before it is even finalized and signed off, Treasury needs to make sure that it doesn't have clauses in there that will require additional funding or future funding from the fiscal. So if you look at the table below, this is just, it shows, Honourable Members and Chairperson, the allocation for SAA under payments for financial assets. But of course, as I said earlier, the departments were given money for compensation of employees. So this $5.3 million is part of the money that was given for compensation of employees. So this is just to give you an idea of the total allocations for the Department of Public Enterprises. Then moving to the Post Office, Chairperson and Honourable Members, I think one needs to think about the history of the Post Office, where between 2016-17 to 18-19, the Post Office was given an accumulated amount of 7.3 billion, and this amount was given to the Post Office for a turnaround plan, but even now we're still not seeing any turnaround plans, and it's very difficult for the Post Office to account for the 7.3 billion that was given to them in between those years. There's still a lot of financial weaknesses in the Post Office, and we are engaging with the Department of Communications and Digital Technologies to finalize a credible turnaround plan for this entity. But given the fact that in the past, 7.3 billion was allocated to the post office and the entity did not turn around, the following conditions are aimed at ensuring that, one, there's accountability, two, the entity turns around, and three, for sustainability. So the first one, basically, Chairperson and Honourable Members, is that the accounting authority and the management of SAPO has to be held accountable for the decisions taken to withdraw statutory and other payments deducted from employees' salary and not paid over to the relevant authorities. This involves the South African Revenue Services, the medical aids, and all of that. So what happened was, the post office made a decision that they will be deducting money from employees, but that money was not paid to these relevant authorities, therefore creating a liability not only for the post office but also for these authorities. The second one, Chairperson, that we really have to think about is we have to put the post office, because of its inability to implement the turnaround plans, we have to consider having or putting SAPO under administration. If not so, then there has to be at least an oversight committee, and this must be established between the National Treasury and the department. We also have to look at what is the future of the post office, and the department has been working on a market study. And the future of the post office or their strategy or their turnaround plan has to be aligned to this market study and the policy objectives that are set out in the white paper. The fourth one, Chairperson, which is very critical for this bailout, is that the post office has to sell all their non-core assets, including properties that they are no longer using. But this is what is key here, Chairperson and Honourable Members, is that the price for the sale of this non-core asset has to resemble some market rates, because the last thing you need is to sell your assets by way below market rates and you don't end up getting value for money. So the post office or the department for that matter needs to make sure that they hire a property valuer, so that an independent property valuer, so that when the post office then starts disposing of these assets that they are no longer requiring, then the value is aligned to what the property is valued, instead of just disposing these assets by less than market value. So, Honourable Members and Chairperson, this is the 2.4 billion that we're proposing that it will be considered by Parliament for appropriation to the post office on condition that they meet the conditions that we are putting forward as the National Treasury. And this is 2.4 under financial assets. Then another entity, Chairperson, where we're looking at, by the way, the South African Post Office and the South African Airways, we basically will be using funding from understanding in some of the votes. When it comes to the land bank, the minister announced the 5 billion in his speech, and this 5 billion has been there for 2 or so years now. We rose it up last year because the conditions were not met, but this year we will be allocating this amount, and these are the conditions that will be attached to the allocation for the land bank. And the first one basically is that the land bank needs to provide assurance that they can comply with effective financial management and internal controls. If they can't, then of course the funds will not be transferred. We will require that there's remedial measures that will be put in place just to make sure there's effective financial management. The land bank also, Chairperson, will be required to provide evidence that it will be able to reinvest this funding, just to make sure they safeguard the 5 billion from any any legal actions by the lenders, because the last thing we need is to have a $5 billion that most of it is used for paying legal claims rather than its intended purpose. The land bank and the treasury must then enter into an agreement regarding the business plans and the operationalization of the blended finance portion of this $5 billion, and we're splitting the $5 billion where $3 billion of that should be blended finance program, and then the maximum of $2 billion should be used to cure some of the default position. And then lastly, Chairperson, the board must just ensure that the $5 billion is utilized only as specified and approved by the Minister of Finance, as stated in these conditions, and is not used for anything else. So for the National Treasury vote, where the land bank reports to, is only an addition of $5 billion. Then, Chairperson, we also proposing that an additional $300 million be provided or added to the political party funding. Before I just go into the numbers, let me just explain this table that you see here. So in the 2019 medium-term expenditure framework, $500 million was allocated for political party funding. But in 2022, MTF period, we allocated the normal baseline amount of $1,058 million, but we also added 171 in 2022-23, 178 in 23-24, and 187 in 24-25 to get a total of $536 million that was added to political party funds. And in those current 2023 MTEF, we're proposing an additional allocation for the year of 22-23 of $300 million, and this of course will increase the total to $1.740 billion. And of course, there's also money that is allocated. This $1.7 billion will be allocated through the IEC, Department of Home Affairs. But of course, there's also allocations for political party allowances, and these are allocated to Parliament. So for 23-24, there's about $516 million increasing to $539 and $561 in 2025-26. This is just showing you the allocation, because it is a transfer to the IEC. $300 million will be transferred for represented political party funds operations. Chairperson, these are all the transactions that are included in the second adjustment appropriation bill for your consideration. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mampo, for the presentation on the 2022-23 Second Adjustment Bill. Honorable members of the committee, you know how we do it. Can I have indications of the honorable members who would like to engage with the presentations, first with the Division of Revenue Bill, and then with the Adjustment Appropriation Bill. So as you ask questions, you say this one is for Division of Revenue and this one is for the adjustment. Okay, first person.
Chair, it's Honorable Sarupin.
Honorable Sarupin. Good morning, Honorable Sarupin. How are you?
I'm good, and yourself, Chairperson?
Good, thank you. We missed you yesterday.
Likewise.
Thank you. Next, yes?
Peters.
Honorable Peters. Honorable members, I'm listening.
Matafa.
Honorable Matafa. We missed you yesterday, Honorable Peters. We got the apology that you are not feeling well. Hope you are feeling better today.
Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Matafa. After Matafa, honorable members. Honorable members, are you struggling with your connectivity?
Kaiso, Chair.
Honorable Kaiso. Honorable members. Okay. Okay, honorable members, let's start. Honorable Sarupen, please come in.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. My apologies for the video. Load shedding has just struck me today. Chair, with regards to the Division of Revenue Bill, and my question pertains entirely to that, I think that part of the exercise that was missing in the Division of Revenue Bill this year is, since municipalities are dependent on two sources of funding, one is, of course, grants from national government, the other is own revenue, the impact of load shedding on municipalities in terms of their finances. And Chair, you know, I in particular, and many of my colleagues and many in this committee, lambaste municipalities for corruption and for failing to do what they're supposed to do, and so on. But in the last 24 months, Chairperson, what has happened is, as load shedding has accelerated, it's completely destroyed the finances of municipalities, because the system that was designed for municipal funding was built on reselling of electricity at a profit to fund other municipal services. So the municipalities add 5%, 10% onto their reselling of electricity, higher for industrial customers, of course, and they use that to pay for roads, to pay for parks, to pay for public amenities, which make a loss, to pay for repairs, to pay for a lot of OPEX. Now, today, National Treasury has given us a ton of information on CAPEX and all of the grants for CAPEX at municipalities, and that's wonderful, and it is very good. But they did point out that municipalities are struggling with maintenance, but there's very little by way of OPEX. And in addition to that, Chairperson, what has also happened is many municipalities have had to purchase generators for water treatment plants in order to keep the water clean, for pump stations to keep the water going. And where they haven't, Chen, I have a lot of family in places like rural Dundee and up and down rural KwaZulu-Natal, and I'm sure you do as well. The simple reality is that the losses due to load shedding and of revenue and the cost of generators means that a lot of small towns up and down the country are now going without water for 3 or 4 or 5 days a week. And this is not because of corruption. It is not because of mismanagement. It is because the funding model for municipalities no longer works in an environment where you don't have 12 hours of electricity a day and they cannot resell it. So Ekurhuleni is spending 17 million rand in diesel a day just to keep its IT systems going, for example. That's hundreds of millions of rands in diesel a month just to keep the water treatment plants and water pump stations going. Rand Water is buckling as well, and we've seen outages up and down Gauteng this last week, and it all comes down back to something very simple. The municipal funding model is now broken. And with load shedding a fact of life, and my camera's not on because I'm load shed right now, it is incumbent upon National Treasury to fundamentally review and change the funding models of municipalities. And I'm very disappointed, Chair, that we saw nothing from National Treasury on the impact of load shedding and municipal finances, how they're going to plug the gap, how we're going to make sure that water pump stations continue to function, how municipalities are going to continue to do what they do when they're losing 50% of their revenue and the bulk of their revenue comes from that. So I'd like to find out from Treasury when they're going to undertake an exercise like that to consolidate all this information and to bring revisions to the Division of Revenue in future years, because looking at this, yes, I see 10% over 3 years increase, but it's not going to be sufficient to cover the losses that are coming. And I've looked through various municipalities' finances in the last weeks to see what is going on, to understand why in Dundee there's no water for 4 days a week, to understand why here in Gauteng there have been issues, to understand why there have been issues even in the Western Cape. And it comes down to the fact that the funding model is broken. So I'd like to ask National Treasury, when are you going to do a comprehensive review of the funding model for municipalities in light of what load shedding has done to the previously constructed funding model? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Sarupin. Honorable Peters.
Thank you. A load shedding challenge. So if you agree, I will not switch on my my video. Is it correct, Chair?
Yes, perfect. Continue, Honorable Peters.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks to the team from National Treasury for the presentation. As they have presented today, Chair, my questions are very at three elements, but I think it would be of the same. Whilst we appreciate the 528 plus that is given for the subsidization of the indigents, especially those who earn old age grants, where you have in the household a umkhulu no makhulu or umkhulu no gogo who are covered in this situation. If you look at it, Chair, with 528, if you deduct for electricity, you would believe that indlu kamkhulu no gogo will not consume more than what the indigent policy provides for. But unfortunately, because you find umkhulu no gogo staying with abazukulwana, and some of these abazukulwana, you'd find that they get child support grants, but the parents of these abazukulwana, obo mama and obo tata babo, they are not helping umkhulu no gogo with the child support grant. So what is a national treasury working together with municipalities going to do to make sure that you alleviate the pressure? There was I think around the year 2010 to up to 12, a proposal that we have one household, 1 meter. And because the mkhulus and mbukoko trying to make additional income, they would bring in people who tasha the back rooms if they do have, or to put up shacks in the yard. And they would be drawing electricity from the main household. And that would then drive the consumption up, leaving the mkhulu no gogo not being able to qualify for the indigent grant because of the household consumption. So I would want to know from National Treasury, Chair, how are they going to ensure, working together with SALGA and COCTA, that the one household and 1 meter is implemented and is taken up by the different households, because some of them were literally refusing to take up these meter arrangements, because I believe that would be the best approach where we pay as we go for electricity. And then the issue related to the very indigent, Chairperson, there's a household where you have your beneficiaries of the SRD being the main breadwinners or the main income. Is National Treasury also considering and also advising municipality to cover these households with the indigent grant? Because as you can see, the grant, if there are two, it's a couple, they would be getting something like 700. So believing that they are also indigent, they need to probably be covered. So that is my question. And if that decision is made, how is National Treasury going to fund that? The issue, another issue, Chairperson, is related to the municipal debt that I don't know whether I heard well, but I didn't hear it explained in detail by National Treasury today, the issue of municipal debt that would be, I don't want to use the word offset, but be covered or be made good by national government, if I were ahead. Well, which municipalities are we talking about? And what is the total cost of the debt that municipalities have to ESCOM? But equally, Chair, it is not enough just to speak about paying off a municipal debt. National Treasury is fully aware of the national departments that have been lined up here, which annually get an increase or in one program or the other. They are owing municipalities huge sums of money. I would mention the province, but there was a province that owed a municipality more than 800 million. What is National Treasury together with COCTA and SALGA going to do that at these departments pay municipalities? Equally so, Chairperson, there is this big challenge by the companies that are raking in billions, who are also not paying municipalities and ESCOM. What is the setup with regard to those? Is it not about time that they get blacklisted or, for a better word, named and shamed? Because I would believe that big business and even medium to bigger companies, they do make money, they do make profits, and they are bound to pay for services that municipalities and ESCOM provide. So, Chairperson, my questions are related to this, because I would believe that with business and departments of government, the municipal debt would really be lowered. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Peters. Honorable Matasa, please come in.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Chair, Dr. Mampo and the team. Chair, like Honorable Peters, I'm being load shed. I'm going to request to keep my video off. Chair, I thank you very much, Chair. I only have three questions, Chair, and I think all of them are related. The first one is almost similar to what Honorable Sarupen was speaking to in terms of the funding model. I acknowledge what he is saying, and I'm not in any way responding, Chair. I'm just underscoring my question. Whilst we agree that maybe a review is necessary, the issue that I'm going to raise, Chair, has been obtaining even before the advent of COVID. And it's the problem of spending, it's the problem of completing programs that are initiated at the municipal level. Now, why I'm raising on this one, Chair, is that in the previous MTBPS, the Treasury made pronouncement on six areas of intervention that they think will assist the municipalities. Now, I just want to find out from Dr. Mampo, as much as we acknowledge the increase in the allocations, the problem is that there will most likely be underspending on the grants, there will be underspending on the money that is allocated, and it will come back. So is there a particular process or system in place to ensure that those areas identified are implemented, monitored, and evaluated for impact? Because if we're not going to do that, Chair, we are going to have a serious challenge, which leads me to my second point. And this point is raised by the FFC in the presentation yesterday. The FFC makes an observation, Chair, that the infrastructure investment is actually accelerating on the side of SOEs and decelerating on the side of other spheres of government. Could it not be that just like normal, where nature does not allow a vacuum, the incapacity or the lack of capabilities by these other spheres would naturally lead to the investment migrating to SOEs, simply because in the current economic policy framework that the government has presented, the ERRP, one of the anchors is infrastructure development, and it cannot be compromised. So while the FFC is raising a concern, I think also we should accept the fact that SOEs also are required to play a constitutional mandate of ensuring that services and as well as infrastructure is provided. So my question to the Dr. Mampo and the team is, what is the view? What is your view as far as this observation of the FFC is concerned? One, what do you think is the reason? Two, is there a way that we ensure that this investment at the SOE level is not in vain? But equally, the third point is, how then do we ensure that we assist the local government space and provinces to spend their grants? Because these allocations that we are speaking about will be fruitless if we are not going to make sure that we follow them up. Chair, I think the two points, and this one that I'm raising, maybe might require that the committee somehow interfaces with the committee on COGTA or the ministry. And it's with regard to the disjunctures in the corporate governance model. And I'll give a simple example, Chair. This committee has pronounced very strongly on the need to fast track the eradication of the bucket system, particularly in schooling facilities. When we had the Department of Water, they say, yes, we are ready. Unfortunately, we do not have the bulk infrastructure to be able to connect the modernized infrastructure. Now, the bulk infrastructure is not there and is the responsibility of the municipality. So there is a problem there. So I think somehow we need to go to the bottom of this, so that the reports that we saw of the 400 million that the education department in the Eastern Cape and KZN lost back to Treasury or lost to another province does not happen because of the failures of the municipality. Another related example, Chair, in my constituency in Centurion, the province brings social houses. The social houses are completed. A connection is required into the bulk services. The municipality is unable to develop that particular pipe. They say it's a pipe, but I'll call it bulk infrastructure connection. Now the houses remain unallocated. As we speak, they are being invaded. Hence, I'm saying maybe we need to review the effectiveness of those six areas of identification by Treasury to say how then best we ensure that we assist municipalities which struggle. Chair, the last point is on the usage of Section 139. By provinces. It might not be the competency of Treasury, but I think equally as they also interface with other committees, particularly COGTA, I'll speak to that. Maybe provinces need to be empowered to use the 139 in other areas besides the financial inability or political instability of municipalities to intervene. And I'll give a simple example, Chair. If you go to Rosefield, you will be aware, Chair, that I had posted in our ANC portal a complaint by a resident in Tshwane or in Joburg about the state of Rosefields in Kempton Park. Again, you go to Kensington in Johannesburg. Every second house is a panel beater. Every second house is a car repair shop. And these are happening in residential areas. So I think, Chair, the failure of municipalities to implement the bylaws is in contravention of their constitutional mandate, and which then empowers provinces to invoke Section 139 and intervene. Because if you allow spray painting, car repairs, car mechanics in residential areas, you are putting the risk at the life of other residents at risk. So that one, Chair, is just a diversion. But I think that it's important that we start considering empowering provinces to effectively use the Section 139 of the Constitution instead of only waiting where there are areas of political instability and poor financial management. I will pause there, Chair, for now. If there will be other areas that come to mind, I'll request to come back if you allow us. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you so much, Honorable Matafa. Honorable Kaiso.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and members on the platform. and the delegation of the Treasury, led by Dr. Mampo. And thank you very much for the presentation. Honorable Chair, I have a challenge of load shedding here. As you see me, I'm at the desk. So can you allow me to switch off the video so that I can, yes. But I have also the challenge, like other honorable members have a challenge with load shedding. Chair, I just have two questions, the rest will be input. Firstly, I just want to understand, well, of course, let me start first by acknowledging this presentation on the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill, which when one looks at it, it has a high element of redistribution, but also there are questions for clarity that one would seek to understand to make a lot of sense. Firstly, is to what an extent does this bill covers or look at what has been declared as electricity disaster and nationally, to what an extent does this Division of Revenue Amendment Bill would go to that level? I'm referring specifically on specific items that came out of the State of the Nation's address. Like your rolling out of the solar system, panel system, so for the poor. So I just want to know to what an extent does now the Division of Revenue Bill would go to cover that. So I just wanted to understand that, so that I should not assume that that is just automatic, whereas it is something that is not going to be well reflected in the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill. On the second adjustment appropriation bill, I just want to know from Dr. Mampo and your team, to what an extent does the adjustment, let me rephrase my question. To what extent does the Division of Revenue Amendment Bill talk to economic recovery plan in its entirety? I just want to have that grasp because it's very, very much important to highlight those critical areas in as far as the Division of Amendment Bill is concerned. Because if it doesn't reflect it, then I would want to have a problem. But then I deliberately want to hear from Treasury that now it actually has these areas focused in as far as economic recovery plan is concerned, because that's where the major problem surrounding the economy is centered. On the second adjustment amendment bill, I just want to go on the issue raised by Dr. Mampo on South African Post Office. That there are a number of grey areas which have been rent. Some are of quite concern. There is serious concern because I do not understand why would the South African Post Office just jump and butcher workers by promising a retrenchment of 6,000 workers. Whereas when you read the performance of the South African Post Office, you see things such as workers, money not being paid to service providers, like your medical aid and other statutory deductions not being paid over. And yet the South African Post Office quickly jumps to say, I will retrench 6,000 workers. I think it was going to be proper that they be advised to halt that process, complete the turnaround strategies, of course, working with the interest parties, like the unions there, to be engaged, so that now every avenue is very clear that what is supposed to happen in as far as post office is concerned. It is very much disappointing to see such measures, such developments, such as failure to emerge with a turnaround plan. It's a very serious statement for one. So with the SAA, it really needs to, that matter of affecting the SAA needs to find its conclusion, because it's for quite a long time that now we've been deliberating on this matter, but it can't find any serious progress as far as performance is concerned. So, Chair, I think I'm covered with the rest of the input of my colleagues. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable. Let me check if there are any other honorable member who would like to come in before I do. Honorable Matafa?
Chairperson. Chairperson. Excuse me for this, Chairperson. On the division of revenue, I asked these two questions to the minister, but I feel I should ask them again. Particularly on the recommendations by SPF. What is it? What is it that informs the vertical, you know, kind of transfers? What is it? I'm putting this question deliberately today, Chairperson. Is there some kind of a barometer of measurement of capacity before you do the transfers, or it's taken as a norm? Perhaps let me ask that one. The other one was a bit political. Let me ask just this one, Chair. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Matafa, do you want to say something?
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Chairperson. No, I am fine. Besides to say, on the adjustment appropriation, we welcome the conditions that are attached to the recapitalization of these entities, something that the committee has been requesting for in previous engagements, that where money goes, it cannot be on a clean slate or a blank check. There must be conditions that must be adhered to, and they are very much welcome. Well done, Team Treasurer. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Oral Matafa. Oral Sarupen, do you have something to add? Yes. I was saying, anything from your side?
Nothing from my side, Chair.
Thank you. Oral Kaiso?
Nothing from my side, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Let me come in. Thank you, Wendy, and the team, Dr. Mark and the team, for the presentations on the two bills. Quickly, the Union of Revenue Bill. I just want to check, Wendy, how do you decide whether an allocation is through the equitable share, a direct grant, indirect or conditional grant, whatever? So how do you decide on that one to say this is the most optimal way of distributing money? And as you do that, please just explain for our benefit, the benefit of the public there. just explaining exactly these types of grants, just saying the conditional grant, the direct grant, and so on, exactly how do they differ from each other? For instance, why is ECD a provincial conditional grant and not provided through the provincial equity share? That's one. I hope you get my drift. provincial and the local emergency housing grants, they cease. And the reason that was cited was a flexibility. I've got no qualms about that, but I was just thinking, why don't we have this type of intervention because I'm sure the national department definitely needs to have an intervention of some sort, the provincial and local. Why is it an either or? why is it not allocated amongst the three spheres of government? Because I'm sure different responsibilities and calls will come from the all three spheres of government. As I was listening to you, within your team, generally, when you with what did you say the message that you are communicating with this division of revenue bill, say, yeah, let me say, what is the message exactly that you are trying to communicate with the revenue bill? And perhaps you will say what I'm responding to, broadly speaking. Perhaps this is related to the question raised by Honorable Sarupen again around electricity. I just want to check that when municipalities are pressed as they are, as far as their revenues are concerned, there'll always be a tendency to get revenues wherever they can and try to start charging super profits. But the question here is that what control do we have or do we put on municipalities as far as the pricing of electricity at that level is concerned, just to make sure that the markup that they put is controlled. I'm sure that applies also to water. Remember that ultimately we as government want to make sure that the residents and the citizens, they get these services. And so to try and deal with the question of, for instance, high markups and end up putting a lot of people under strain, as we know that the cost of living is too high. So I'm just saying, is there any intervention as far as the markups that the municipalities are allowed to put when it comes to water and electricity? Next question is around the free basic services of 70.9 billion rand. Is 6.7 billion rand and 10 billion rand part of the 70.9 billion rand? I think it's a straightforward to that one. Next question on section 7, you talk about on the, I think that's what when you are, the amendments that you are making on the on section 7, the conditional allocation to provinces. Just to answer or perhaps to share that, what does pledging of provincial grants mean? Pledging of provincial grants. You are saying section 7, conditional allocation of provinces, provides for the pledging of provincial grants. Just to explain to us what does that mean? I think that's as far as the Division of Revenue Bill is concerned. Then on the Dr. Mampo, I think that's when you were talking about the disposal of the assets of the post offices. You spoke about us getting value for the assets that will be disposing. When I say us, I'm as South Africans, but the post office. So that talks to the proper evaluation of the assets that are going to be disposed. So I know that when it comes to SAA, there have been some confidentialities that are there, but want to make the same call, right? That is the strategic equity partner which comes in must pay the market value of SAA. And we are calling on the Minister of Finance
as the owner of this bill to make sure that there's proper valuation, there's fair value of the asset that is being disposed of. And again, the Minister of Finance, you know, when you get a strategic equity partner, amongst other things, is to put money into the company and many other things, for instance, management and so on and so forth. Exactly what are we getting from this strategic equity partner? The Minister of Finance must be, as the owner of this bill, the money bills presented to us, he must be appraised of that. And that at the right time, once those things, that information must be shared with Parliament. This is evaluation that was made for the Takatsu deal. That's the money that was paid, and this is the percentage, and this is the evaluation that was made, and this is the percentage that this is the percentage that is being disposed of. That will have to be reported to Parliament. I think that to make sure that there's transparency recapitalize SAP. On the disposal of the non-core assets of the post office, I think while I agree with you that we should be able to make sure that there's a proper valuation of the assets that will be disposed. But as you know, that you'll get most of these assets in the rural areas and so on and so forth. Would like you to ensure that the communities who have always been the beneficiaries of those assets in those areas are also benefiting. It would be very unfortunate if people from other areas they come to Tofimvaba and start owning the post office there, or perhaps the asset which will be disposed there, and at the expense of them. So when we look at this type of the assets that are owned by the post office, I think the question of communities living around those places should be able to be considered as beneficiaries. On this, we should not only be looking at the pecuniary price, we should also be looking at the social price of those areas. For instance, let me say there is a land which is owned by the post office. I think the people around those areas would have to be considered when we deal that, especially because the people of South Africa are now coming in, and I think it's right recapitalizing the post office because of the role that post offices play in those distressed and rural communities. I think I would leave it at that, and firstly allow Wendy and your team to come in and respond to the questions which have been raised by the other members. And after you, then we'll request Dr. Mampo to come in. Wendy?
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, I'm joined by quite a big team from the Intergovernmental Relations Unit in National Treasury, and I would like to make special mention of Jan Hutton that's joined us, as well as Ukhali, that is part of the provincial budget analysis team that can deal with some of the provincial questions as well. Although there were few, the majority of them actually focused on municipalities. I'm going to assign questions to people concerned, and then see how we can deal with that. The one about the issue about, is National Treasury looking at the impact of load shedding on municipalities, particularly their finances, and are we doing any work in this regard? I'll ask Jan Hutton to respond, and I'll add if necessary. Then with regard to support of indigent policies, which is a decision by municipalities, and how it's applied and how it impacts on particularly in cases where backshot SACs are responsible as well. I'll ask Letsepa to deal with that question. The one about the Eskom debt, Jan, if you can deal with that one. Then with regard also to the six areas identified to support municipalities, Jan, that is also yours. Then with regard to spend on infrastructure grants, Jan, if you can deal with the local government aspect, and Kholi, if you can deal with the provincial aspect, and then the disjuncture of the infrastructure in terms of provinces and municipalities, you know, Jan and Kholi, and I can add to that as well. The issue about the interventions being broader than and support provided to provinces to do those interventions broader than just finances. Jan, that is yours. With regard to the rooftop solar, if I can ask either Letsepa to deal with that one or Zetu. Then with regard to the recommendations of the FFC, I'll deal with that one. I'll also deal with the one about the classification of the various grants in the system. And then the emergency one I'll also deal with, and the message we want to communicate. And then the pricing of electricity, Jan, can you take the first step and we can add, given that the majority of questions are added or given to Jan, Jan, can you go first? If I can then ask my team to follow, Ukhali, can you then deal with the provincial ones and I'll conclude. So Jan, over to you.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and members of the committee. Hopefully I am audible. Can you hear me, Chair?
Yes, you are.
So listening to the questions and the conversation, Honourable Chair, my gut feeling is indicating that we need to make time to brief the committee properly on the local government as a package. But obviously, I'll try to respond to the specific questions because some of the questions is wider than the Division of Revenue Act. Just for the committee's benefit, Wendy and her team is responsible to formulate the Division of Revenue Bill. Once the committee and parliament adopt and approve the Division of Revenue Bill, myself and Ukhali take over the overall implementation responsibility, in my case, in the local government side, Honorable Chair. And the reason why I argue or put the proposal forward that perhaps we should brief you broader on the local government support and reforms that we oversee, if you look at the money set aside in the Division of Revenue Bill for local government, the equitable share is about 83.7 billion, 48.7 billion for grants. But Chairperson, if one look at the overall budget that municipalities table, which the Treasury normally publishes once a year, the aggregated position, this constitute on average about 28% of the total revenue pot to the disposal of local government. So if you ask me what is the overall budget, I would say it's about 550, between 550 billion and 560 billion. Therefore, the revenue side of municipality constitute of the equitable share, conditional grants, and then own revenue, which is also quite a substantive amount. Obviously, we recognize that in the metro space, it's higher proportionally to the other municipalities. Chairperson, there was a question, will the Treasury reconsider, or what's the Treasury's plans to reconsider the funding model. This is Wendy's area of responsibility, but my understanding is the Minister of Finance have committed at the summit that was held last year, facilitated and organized by the Minister of Corporate Governance and Traditional Affairs, that the Treasury will go through a process and Wendy's team is the appropriate team that responds. So the answer is there's certainly a consideration to rethink and see what's possible. And obviously it will be a systematic process like the Treasury normally do, Chairperson. With regard to the question specifically on the electricity crisis and whether there's funding set aside. So Chairperson, I think the first principle that's very important to understand is in the legislation, specifically the disaster legislation, and it's obviously applicable to the electricity crisis as well, that the first principle is we use current resources. So that implies that until the fiscals have done technical work, that the first advice we would give to municipalities is to reprioritize the budgets. And Honorable Chair, we issue two budget circulars annually to guide municipalities how to go about to prepare their budget for the next cycle. So early in December, we've issued the first circular, and in the next few days, we will issue the second circular based on the budget that's been tabled in Parliament. So Chairperson, what we have done, and here SALGA has taken the lead, they have sent out a survey to all municipalities to provide us with quite detailed information on what is their challenges, the financial implications, and that will certainly be considered as an input into a process going forward, whether to find additional resources or not. So for now, our advice would be municipalities must table their budgets by the 31st of March. So there's a window of opportunity for them to reprioritize their spending to give effect to this new development. But Chair, certainly the work that SALGA started and what we normally do, we work closely with themselves and DECOG, and all of these inputs will then be considered as the process unfolds. Chairperson, as far as the question on the Eskom debt relief bill, there was a question whether municipalities is going to benefit from this process. The answer is absolutely yes. So the conditions that the Minister of Finance has articulated in Annex W as part of the budget documentation, we are working, Chairperson, on guidelines to help municipalities and share with them the criteria that will be applicable in order for them to benefit. Now, that amount that's part of the package, the overall 254 billion rand, theoretically, Chairperson, one could argue included in that amount is something like 57 billion rand. That is the current amount that municipalities owe Eskom. And therefore, those six items that the Honorable Member has referred to, there's going to be conditions associated with all of those six priority areas. And one of them, which we think is fundamental, is municipalities in law is supposed to table a funded budget. Chairperson, and just the latest information for the benefit of a committee, the previous financial year, we had 112 municipal budgets that was adopted by councils that was unfunded, 112. we as provincial, national provincial treasury assess all municipal budgets once a year before the municipalities are allowed to adopt it in council by the end of May. That number is reduced to 106. As far as overall performance, how many municipalities is in financial distress? Chair, we issue once a year the state of local government report, and the number has decreased from 175 to 165. In that report, Chair, we use 13 indicators to determine which municipalities is then in financial distress. Chair, that's a stage before you have financial problems. That's the stage before you have a financial crisis. And those two parts, if the members want to know the detail, if you meet the criteria for section 138 of the MFMA, that will give you the number of municipalities that have financial problems. And if you want to determine the municipality in crisis, it's section 140. Chairperson, we quarterly publish the financial results for all 257 municipalities. We do this now religiously, Chair, for the last 14 years. So it's the financial performance, it's the conditional grant performance, but we have added this information to give all the oversight bodies, including Parliament, the information of which municipalities meet these criteria and conditions. So Chairperson, I can certainly make that available to the Secretariat if you so wish. Chairperson, as far as the underspending is concerned.
Please, before I forget.
I'll certainly do that, Chairperson, yeah. Because I think it's important information for the committee, not only the State of Local Government report, not only this quarterly section 71, but the information on municipalities in distress and in financial crisis. Chairperson, if you ask us on the performance of municipalities and why they struggle to spend their grants, the number on average, and if we now look at the equitable sheds at 83.7 billion and grants 48.7, the annual amount that we normally identified as potential underspending is in the vicinity of about 4 billion rand. But Chair, we've got a very specific process that we then go through with municipalities. And again, it's step by step articulated in our budget circulars, Chair. And I also think I should share that with the committee. Chair, as far as the interventions process is concerned, the National Treasury has commissioned a study in 2017 to determine the effectiveness of the intervention process. Chair, of the 119 interventions throughout a four-year period, the study revealed that one was successful. And the conclusion of the study is that national government and provincial government and municipalities have not implemented our own legislation appropriately. So what the Treasury has done is we have reconsidered the whole intervention framework. We've done roadshows with the two deputy ministers of finance and COCTA throughout the country. We've had engagement with all provinces, all MSCs of finance, all MSCs of COCTA, and then gone through a process to educate and capacitate how the intervention should be done going forward. So, Honorable Chair, we've also gone to the point where we've identified the 43 municipalities in crisis and the recommended mode of intervention. So, Chair, this one, we have certainly done a lot of work. We're not claiming that it's perfect, but at least we're starting to invoke the right provisions of the Constitution linked to the correct provisions of the Municipal Finance Management Act. Chairperson, as far as those eight or six priority areas, they are still relevant. And we have what we call a Municipal Financial Management Improvement Program, wherein we invest quite substantially in, and this is to conform to Section 154 of the Constitution, Chair, to provide support. And that support is in the form of guidelines, circulars, training sessions, capacitation sessions. So, Chair, that's quite extensive, but to make sure that the municipalities understood the changes in the annual division of revenue bill, once approved by Parliament, we have provincial roadshows and we have engagement with the sector departments to take them through all the changes in the legislation to help them to make the implementation of that much more meaningful, and also to assist, for instance, in the infrastructure space. We use the MISA agency in COCTA to help municipalities on the infrastructure side, and our own teams also is involved. So, Chairperson, I'm almost at the end of my input. As far as the overall debt of the municipalities, what the consumers owe municipalities, Chairperson, we published that result religiously as part of the Section 71 process. The number is 289.8 billion. And one of the honorable members have raised the issue that national government, provincial government owe municipalities. Chair, we are fully aware of that. The amount is about 23 billion rand. And equally, the same way we put pressure on municipalities to honor their commitments, similar process happens at the national provincial level. The Director General of the Treasury have issued letters, not once, not twice, on a number of occasions to these departments to say you need to respect the law, you need to respect the fact that there's somebody else that you provided a service for that needs to be compensated. Chairperson, I think that is the part where I can stop for now, except the bylaw enforcement. That is critical. In the municipal case, once a bylaw is adopted by council, it's got the status of law. And what we've observed, Chair, is that municipalities sometimes is a bit reluctant to enforce their own bylaws, and that certainly requires a broader intervention between National Treasury, COCTA, and SELGA. Chair, perhaps that's where I can stop, except Wendy, if I've missed something. Thank you.
Thanks. Can I then hand over to Holly? Mukhali, maybe if you can ask you to deal with the underspending or assisting provinces to deal with the underspending on conditional grants. And maybe also just indicate in your benchmarking exercise what you do to ensure that there's better alignment between provincial budgets and municipal budgets as well. I think it's important information to the committee. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members. Good morning, and Honorable Chair, and thank you, Wendy. So in terms of the spending on conditional grants, as much as we look at the total spending at end of each financial year, but performance will differ from one province to the other. So for example, in the previous financial year, I look at different grants. So the education infrastructure grant spent 93% of its budget for the 21-22 financial year. But if you look deeper in terms of performance of each province, three provinces that underspent, for example, by more than each underspent by more than 200 million. And one of them, that 200 million was in addition to some funds taken from it through the Section 18 that Wendy spoke about of the stopping and reallocation. So some part of how the sectors tried to minimize underspending at the end of the financial year. So they will stop from the province that is not performing, in particular, especially the infrastructure grants, and give to the province that are able to absorb that funds and spend it before the end of the financial year. But generally, if you look at the provincial roads maintenance grant, it's a grant that generally performs well. Last year, they spent 97.7% of their budget. So in our view, they've spent well. So the grant that did not necessarily do so much well is the health facility revitalization grant within health. And it was a surprise because in the year of COVID, they did exceptionally well. They were able to, their turnaround times in terms of delivery was much quicker. So in this regard, we're hoping that the sector would have learned something from the lessons from when they were putting those temporary beds to ensure that they, moving forward, they cannot use that particular skill or the learnings to other infrastructure projects. So the other grant that also tends to have stopping and allocation is the Human Settlement Development Grant as well. As you know, it's for providing housing. So last year, it also spent 96.6. But for this financial year, which is ending end of this month, we're expecting that for most, if not all of this grant, we're expecting a better performance because when we compared what the province spent end of December 2022 and end of December 2021, so there's been a bit of improvement. In December 2021, they had spent at the time less than 60%. But if you look this year, on average, if you look at the spending on infrastructure in provinces, they had spent 62.5%. So in our view, we expect that there will be a little bit of improvement in that regard. And generally, the delays around procurement, most of the time is around procurement and also those construction mafias that tends to go on site and stop the work on site. So in terms of alignment of those budget of municipal years, so I think that one, if this is a big problem, particularly if, for example, funds are provided to local government in the last quarter of the financial year. So if the transfer, for example, in the human settlement one, so it means then the houses that are going to be built by the municipalities in their last 3 months from, let's say, from April to June are not necessarily accounted for by provinces in their financial year of, let's say, 22-23. So I think it's a big problem, and it's something that I don't think we are winning on it. So I think that alignment, in our view, it's a big problem we're not getting right. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Ukhali, can you maybe also just indicate what you do in the budget process and the budget benchmarking process to get alignment between provincial and municipal spending? Thanks.
So Wendy, we don't necessarily focus on that that much. So that's why I did not focus on it, because essentially when we analyze the budget of provinces during the benchmarks, generally, we look at whether that budget, for example, as members would have heard that the funding provided to education, the funding provided to health, and funding provided for compensation of employees for the capital cost of the wage agreement. We look whether provinces have allocated those funds where they're meant to go. So we want to see in education that money has gone to where it's supposed to go. We look at health. So the issue around alignment is really around, generally, it will be around if there are transfers to municipalities, over that one will ensure that they gazette the transfers, particularly as per the DORA timelines. But generally, we focus more on the priorities of provincial government and national priorities, whether they find expression in provincial department, provincial government budgets. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Maybe just to add to it, because it deals with the question that's been asked. Why do you get infrastructure spending taking place in provinces, but the supporting infrastructure is not in place in province, in municipalities. And the example of the eradication of the bucket system and also the human settlement issue was raised. And although it links up to a budget issue, it links up much more with regard to integrated development planning. Because what needs to be done is when a province decides to do, say, for example, a new housing development, it should consult with the municipality before it actually puts in place that housing rollout. Because what happens in certain cases, provinces go to areas where the land is quite cheap, but there's no municipal services, and they don't put the housing where you know, municipal infrastructure is in place, but the land is a bit more expensive. So there is definitely a need for improved planning and alignment in infrastructure rollout between provinces and municipalities. So maybe just to add to that response, but I'll ask Bongani to come in on the provincial pledging question. Then I'll ask Letsepa to come in on the local government questions, and I'll conclude on that one. Bongani, back to you.
Okay, thanks, Wendy, and thanks again, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members and colleagues. So in terms of what is meant by using of provincial conditional grants for pledging, it essentially means a province can go out to the market to borrow so that they can provide an infrastructure for service delivery, and they can use their future conditional grants allocation to repay that loan. Just so that we make it clear, it is only the MEC of finance within the province that can do that. No one else can do that on behalf of the province. And this sort of condition has existed in a system for a while for municipalities. But essentially that was because municipalities, sort of the infrastructure that they have, lend itself to generating revenue. As an example, if a municipality goes out to borrow so that they can put infrastructure for water or electricity, at the end of the day, they are going to be able to charge sort of for services that are provided and repay that loan using the revenue that they generate. Unfortunately for provinces, that's generally not the case, because if you build a school or a hospital, even the sort of money that those infrastructure generate is not sufficient to repay whatever loan that is sort of being undertaken to provide those. So we are aware of such sort of shortcomings. However, on the other hand, some provinces are putting forward an argument that if I can get X amount of money upfront through borrowing, then I'll be able to eradicate some of the bedrocks in services, which we recognize. So in terms of this pledging of provincial conditional grants, one of sort of the conditions that are put forward for a province to use that is such that they should do it in compliance with the Borrowing Powers of Provincial Government Act, which now requires that all the kind of pledging that needs to be done by provinces has to go through the Loans Coordinating Committee, which is a committee chaired by Minister of Finance, and all the MECs of Finance in the provinces are the members. So if the Loans Coordinating Committee agrees to that pledging happening, then that can be done, because as indicated, there are challenges that we have recognized and are aware of, but some provinces have put forward that them not having a certain like lump sum of money up front to eradicate some services sort of is not it's hindering on service delivery. And Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members, I want to also implore that please do not, because a lot of people sometimes confuse this concept of pledging, which is actually borrowing by provinces, with front loading. Front loading is a totally different concept, which we are not doing, which would mean that national government is borrowing on behalf of provinces to do this. And I just wanted to make that very clear. We are just looking provinces borrowing and not national borrowing on behalf of anyone or any province. Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members.
Thank you. Can I then ask Dr. Pakis to come and with these three questions? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much, Wendy. And good morning again, honorable members. So just to confirm, in terms of the 70.9 billion in terms of the free basic services allocation, yes, it already includes a portion of the 8.1 billion that was added. So I'm saying a portion because some of the money from this 8.1 billion was then provided for the two components that are funding the poor and rural municipalities for redistributive purposes. But the chunk of it really goes to basic services and is already part of the 70.9 billion. So that's one. The second one relates to the solar. So around this issue, honorable members, I think to contribute towards yes.
Please interrupt you because just to make sure that we're in the same page. You have got a slide which talks about 70.9 billion rand, right?
Yes,
on the side, you have got a 6.7 billion rand, which is institutional. And then 10 billion rand community services. So my question was that is 6.7 and 10 billion rand part of 70.9 billion rand now?
Oh, no, honorable chair. So that's specifically on the side aimed at the poor municipality.
Okay.
Yes. No, I thought it was focusing on the new money, the additions and the free basic services allocation. Okay, no, thanks for that clarity, honorable chair. And then as it relates to the second question around the solar panels and how that is being provided for. I think Eskom and municipalities, I think from this next financial year will begin to fund these and other alternative energy sources really. So these rooftop solars and these other energy saving devices will be funded from the INEP grant. So this is the Integrated National Electricity Program grant. So there's one grant for Eskom and then there's one grant for municipalities. So in total, over the MTF, these grants have an allocation of 18.8 billion, of which part of it will then be used based on demand and the applications process through the Department of Mineral Resources, then these will then be funded. At this point, we don't know how many will be funded and made available as this is going to be dependent on the demand and the supply side factors. But definitely it's something that has been responded to. We can report back to you once all the applications in terms of the business plans from these spending agencies have come through on that. Then there's another one, I think, question that relates to the indigent policies as it relates to the backyard shared dwellers. So that one, honorable member, so the National Department of Cooperative Governance has the policy around that, which guides municipalities when they prepare their own indigent policies. So it's covered in the indigent policies in terms of the exclusion and on all. And I do know that it's something that is currently being looked at, both from the operational side of things, which would be then how those are funded from the equitable share, but also from the conditional grant side in terms of how then does government spend on those to better the lives of our households at that level. So this is something that is being looked at with the aim of ensuring that, you know, there's an equitable distribution and a look at for those households living in those conditions. But from our side, from the formula itself, there's no discrimination in terms of where people stay. It really looks at all the poor households as reported by State SSA, so regardless of where they stay. but we can sure take these conversations to our forums with the Department of Cooperative Governance in terms of how they aim in terms of providing guidance to municipalities on that. Yeah, just on the funding model, I think Jan has adequately covered us there. So there are quite a number of questions and also forums that are looking at the funding model for local government. And I think load shedding is at the scale at which it's at now, it's really it's something that has been an issue over the last few years. So the impact varies from one municipality to the other. So a comprehensive response to that can then not be assumed. I think we cannot apply a blanket approach there. So it's important that we continue to find the data that's going to help us inform decisions around how we then relook at the funding model. But it's quite important at this point to also add to the honorable members that in the first year of the MTF, we've indicated that there is an allocation that is, and there's an amount that is unallocated. It's 1.35 billion. So that money is actually looking at the finalization of the ESCOM issue in terms of the bulk tariff increases, but also it's also going to help us look at some of those issues where by the amendment at bill time we would have answered to, including the issue of load shedding. So it's not an issue that hasn't been considered, but we just don't have sufficient in the system, as Jan has through his circular provided, I think, guidance in terms of how the municipality should be dealing with this, but we're also gathering information so that we're also able to see if possible that we can be able to assist municipalities in the short term. Thanks very much, Wendy. I think that covers the 3.5 questions. Thanks.
Thank you so much. And I've got 5 questions, and then we're done with the questions asked. Hopefully we didn't leave anything out. With regard to the recommendations by the FFC, hopefully I'm answering this question correctly, and if not, please advise and I'll retry again. Every year that FFC makes recommendations that relate to the division of revenue, and what that means
how the municipality should be if
we also consult SOLGA, for example. So we do broad consultations that informs in the recommendations that national government then makes with regard to the recommendations by the FFC. Some of the recommendations are quite broad in a policy nature, and what we then do is we implement some of the recommendations in a phased way. Some of the recommendations that the FFC makes require quite a bit of work from our side. So when we respond to the recommendations, we firstly indicate whether we support the recommendation or we do not support the recommendation, and we'll provide the reasons. But in the majority of cases, we do support the recommendations by the FFC, and we then determine the, you know, the best way that we can actually implement it. It goes through the budget process. We consult it with the national departments concerned. Then often the question is posed, why don't we respond to the recommendations that do not relate to the division of revenue? And the issue is that those recommendations do not relate directly to the responsibilities of National Treasury. It relates to policy matters that lies outside the mandate of National Treasury. But what the National Treasury does is the Minister of Finance takes those recommendations, we identify them, and we refer them to the relevant national sector departments for them to directly respond to the FFC. So if you take those two approaches into account, the FFC's all the recommendations should be responded to, but National Treasury mandates are only limited to those that directly relate to the division of revenue. That is how the legislation is crafted, and that is what our responsibility is. But like I do say, we do take it further to try to assist the FFC to deal with other recommendations as well. With regard to how do we decide if something is funded through an equitable share or through a conditional grant, and explain the differences. What the Constitution basically says, Section 229, if I remember correctly, it says that local government and provinces are entitled to an equitable share to provide basic services and perform the functions allocated to them. So when you look at the equitable share, the majority of large functions that are allocated to provinces and municipalities are funded what we call through the unconditional equitable share, because in terms of the Constitution, they're entitled to that funding. So what you would see, if you look at the provincial equitable share formula, the two major components in the, or the largest two components in the provincial equitable share is funding health and education. So we then look at the provincial responsibility to provide those services, and the majority of that is then funded through the provincial equitable share. But the Constitution also says that additional funding can be provided through conditional grants with conditions or without conditions, but all our conditional grants have got conditions to actually further supplement and support provinces and municipalities as well. So if you look at the local government equitable share, again, municipalities fund water, electricity, sanitation, example, to the non-poor households through tariffs that they charge for those services. So the local government equitable share then funds the free basic services component to poor households. It also got other components that specifically support poorer municipalities that do not really, able to get much property rates to fund their general services, for example. So there's those additional complements. So what you will find is that when we've got conditional grants, it generally funds very important national priorities where we want to ensure that those priorities are provided, because it makes a difference to the life of people, and it's very important that those be monitored. For example, a good example of that would be the school nutrition program, where it is essential that poor learners are provided with the necessary meals per day so that they can be concentrating in class and you can get good educational outcomes. But as those programs mature and the processes are put in place, for example, in provinces to do that, the question then gets posed, when is it appropriate then to take that grant, for example, and incorporate it in the provincial equitable share, because that direct monitoring and oversight is not needed anymore. So those are the type of decisions when you make, when is something an equitable share, when is something a conditional grant. And then the other type of conditional grant that you get, and that is the majority of actually conditional grants that you get in the system, is largely infrastructure related, that supports the rollout of infrastructure. So what is quite important there is, particularly with regard to infrastructure grants, there are two types. And the primary type is what we call direct conditional grants. And that is where you allocate the money to the SWE responsible for that responsibility. For example, if you look at education rollout of the schools, that must be rolled out. That is a direct conditional grant where the money is allocated to the national department. The province need to do certain things like submit business plans to the national department. After they've complied with the conditions, the money gets transferred to the province concerned. The province then spends the money and reports back to the national department. But there's also cases where provinces, for example, lack the capacity to do the infrastructure rollout themselves. In certain cases, the backlog is just very, very big. For example, and then we create what we call an indirect grant, and that is where a national department, despite it not being responsible for the provision of infrastructure of educational schools, it does it on behalf of the province, but it does it in collaboration with the province. Again, over time, what you would see as the schools' backlogs are dealt with, over time, you would want to see that money going into the direct conditional grant, but often it takes much longer. That's what we really prefer. Because in a lot of cases, infrastructure rollout is a very difficult business. You also get a situation where the national department actually builds quite good capabilities, where they can often roll out the infrastructure at a cheaper cost than what the province or municipality can do. So in the end, when you convert those type of grants from indirect to direct, so you could see the review that we're undertaking is quite difficult work, quite complex work. We're going to have to ask quite a lot of intrusive questions, because in the end of the day, what we really would want is a conditional grant system that really results in the maximum optimal service delivery outcome while respecting, as far as we can, also the constitutional mandates assigned to provinces and municipalities. So we are doing it in collaboration also with the national departments. That's got very specific views. We're doing it in collaboration with the provinces. We're doing it in collaboration with municipalities. That's often got very opposed in, or different views on how matters should be tackled. So what we want to do is take all those opinions together, analyze it, digest it, and really come to the best solution, and then make the changes to the conditional grant system. And those we will be presenting to the committee as the work unfolds. Chairperson, the questions that you've asked, what are the differences between an equitable share? When do you fund something through an equitable share? When do you fund something through a direct conditional grant? When do you fund something through an indirect conditional grant? It's very, very, very pertinent questions that we will need to deal with when we actually undertake this review. Thank you very much for that question. And then what is the main message that we would like to communicate with this Division of Revenue? And I think it will be applicable to all the Division of Revenue bills that we're really trying to put in place, and really what informs our decision-making process. And why do we have an annual Division of Revenue? Why do we allocate money to provinces and municipalities? And the real reason is what we want to ensure, and particularly given the additional injections that we gave to provinces and municipalities this year, it's very pertinent. What we want to ensure is the continued provision of basic services by provinces and municipalities to their communities. And by doing that, the increased allocations then enable the provinces and municipalities to do two things: to deal with the additional cost attributed to providing those services, such as explained by Dr. Pockies, where the electricity prices have gone up quite substantially, but also to extend access of the services. For example, you do want to ensure that more households that are poor get access to free basic services, for example. So those are the types of reforms that we do. And if you get good and efficient service delivery of public services, such as schooling, such as healthcare, such as water, sanitation, electricity, what you do in the end of the day, you uplift the lives of the poor and the communities. But what you also do is, doing that, you support economic growth in the country. For example, if you've got a good public schooling system, you get well-educated scholars that can go to university or do trade. And then in the end of the day, in that way, you boost economic growth and development as well. So we're trying to do quite a bit by just allocating the money. And what is important, we allocate the money, but the actual service delivery actually vests with the national sector departments, the provinces and the municipalities concerned. Then with regard to the last question, how do we deal with the fact that there's this additional margins that municipalities place on the provision of electricity and water, and what can we do in this regard? The reality is there's actually very little margins actually placed, and maybe Jan, you can also come in here, because one of the key things that we struggle with, municipalities are not, and it's even the bigger municipalities, they struggle to determine cost reflective tariffs. What they often do is they take last year's tariff, they just take CPI or whatever the case may be, and increase their tariffs. So there's often a lot of municipalities actually undercharge, and of course some overcharge. But what we've seen is that with regard to water, there's not really any additional margins added to the water tariffs. It's been a practice in the electricity sector, and that's actually a practice that comes from, yet I don't know, long ago. And that was not a bad practice when electricity tariffs were very, very cheap. And some of the margins that municipalities at that time placed on electricity tariffs were exorbitant. Some of the work that EDR Holdings did, for example, indicated that some municipalities' surcharges as high as 50%, which was not really, that is just exorbitant. So at that stage, it was very, very critical that it be regulated. But what has happened since is electricity prices, because of the bulk going up such a lot, electricity tariffs have gone up. That it's not really the surcharges anymore. Municipalities have now started to actually limit their electricity surcharges or even stop levying surcharges. But what currently National Treasury is doing work, and we're determining to what extent there are surcharges still on electricity tariffs, and if necessary, we will regulate it. But I mean, if a surcharge is in the region of plus minus 5%, that is most, and I'm preempting the outcomes of the work, but for example, say we determine it should be no more than 5%, we can regulate it. We've got the regulatory tools to do it. There's what we call the Municipal Fiscal Powers and Functions Act, and in that act, there's also provision made for the regulation of surcharges on municipal services. But Jan, if you can maybe just come in on what work you're doing to support municipalities with appropriate municipal tariff setting. Thanks.
Thanks, Honourable Chair. Thanks, Wendy. So, Chairperson, the first thing we're advocating as National Treasury that a municipality must run its business like a business. So there's four tariff services: electricity, water, waste, and refuse removal. And it's important that you understand the full cost of running that service. So we've done extensive guidelines, prepared extensive guidelines and tools. We spend enormous amount of time, Chairperson, to train municipalities. And every year when we assess their budgets, this is the focus area. So again, we guide them and say, try to minimize your increases relative to inflation. If it's above that, and there's a logic and a reason for that, disclose it in your budget documents. So the long and short is, Chair, we've also, as part of the MSCOA reform, which is a standard classification system, we have set up the accounts so that we can, with the information that municipalities report to us, Chair, firstly know now what they do with the equitable share. Chair, you'll recall historically the committee asked us, what is municipalities doing with the equitable share? We couldn't answer that question. Now we're in a position, and we're going through a process, Chair, to clean up the information so that if Parliament allocate 100 rand for the equitable share, then we, where we sit as National Treasury, should be able to draw a report and say the 100 rand was used for this purpose. So, Chair, that process is unfolding very fast, and hopefully soon we will be in a position to say that whatever the equitable share is allocated and approved by Parliament, that we can account to the cent of what it's been used. Secondly, that we determine the full cost of the four tariff services, and then systematically take municipalities through a journey where they actually recoup the cost. So if you pay 120 rand for a service, that you're in a position to recoup the 20 rand. We are mindful, Chair, that there's the poorest of the poor that cannot afford this, hence the provision and what the equitable share is meant to be. Unfortunately, Chair, some municipalities do use the equitable share to pay their creditors, and that in itself is a bad practice. So, Chairperson, we are working with municipalities. We're spending enormous amount of time to show them how this should be done, and ultimately they will be in a position then to table meaningful budgets that will give effect to service delivery requirements as per the Constitution. Thanks, Wendy.
Thank you, and sorry, Chair, for coming back. I just looked at the chat, and sorry, I did not get the question correctly. Thanks for clarifying that in the chat, which I really appreciate. With regard to the vertical division to local government in terms of the overall share that goes to local government, what is currently taking place? There is a task team. It is endorsed by the Budget Forum. The Budget Forum consists of the Minister of Finance with the MECs for Finance, and it's also part of that committee is co-opted is the Minister of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs and the MECs. And one of the work streams that we agreed to is to look at that issue as part of the review. Parliament also had a summit, and it also agreed that that issue be looked at. So there is work streams going on where National Treasury is working with the FSC and SALGA and DECOC to look at that matter. And ultimately, the matter will feed into the budget process. But just to make one thing quite clear, although there's formulas in place to deal with the horizontal division of the local government equitable share and also so much the provincial equitable share, there is no formula in place for the vertical division between the spheres, i.e. national provinces and local government. That is informed by the political priorities and budget availability. Because if you look, for example, at all the needs coming through the budget system, it needs to be prioritized to be affordable as well. So the work is ongoing and it is definitely receiving attention. Thanks. That is our story. Thanks.
Wendy and your team, thank you very much on your response to the Division of Revenue Bill questions as posed by the honourable members. Dr. Mampo, please come in.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. There's a bit of a light, so let me just switch off the video. So, Chairperson, I think the critical thing is to get the post office to present the turnaround strategy to the committee. I mean, they presented it to us, and the elements that are part of the strategy are such that it requires a much smaller post office than what we have now. And unfortunately, if you require a smaller post office, then it means you might have to forego some of the employees that work there. But I think it's only fair that they are given an opportunity to provide the strategy that they're planning to implement. Chairperson, I completely agree with you in terms of the market or the valuation of the assets and the focusing on how the communities in those areas are going to benefit from this. But what we also said to the post office was that this must be a non-core asset, so it shouldn't be a situation where the sale of these assets then impacts negatively on the communities that still require the services of the post office. And I mean, in terms of SAA, I'm just going to ask Ravesh to deal with it. But I think what we're going to have to do is that when we get that independent assessment of the value of these assets, we'll definitely work with the post office just to ensure that the state is not taken for a ride in terms of these assets. And just one comment then on the conditions for these entities. I think what is key is trying to make sure that these entities don't come back to the fiscus, or we don't have a situation where they come back after 3 years saying that they were unable to implement some of these turnaround plans. So we will definitely make sure that we enforce these conditions, and it is appreciated that the committee does support us in including these conditions to the different allocations. Thanks, Chair. I'm Ravesh on SAA.
Okay, thanks, Honourable Chair, and thanks, Dr. Madisa. I think just on SAA, Chair, we 100% agree with you and the Honourable Committee in terms of, just understanding
what the SEP deal or transaction will entail, hence the conditions that Dr. Madisa has outlined to the committee, because we would want to review that sale to understand exactly that there will be no further fiscal obligations. We also want to understand, Takatsa, what funding that they will be providing and what are the terms and conditions, but importantly as well that the funding we are providing to SAA, the 1 billion that we're providing as well, is to ensure that the guarantees, which I think currently stands at about 340 million rand, and which there's a facility of 1.5 billion, is also cancelled. So we just want to ensure that for the fiscus, for the National Revenue Fund, that there's no further fiscal obligations, because as you know, historically we have provided around about 50 billion to SAA, and that this SEP deal will be independently verified and also by the National Treasury, but to also ensure that there are no loopholes that we may find that could come back to mean that the fiscus has to further bail out SAA. But Chair, thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Team National Treasury. We will obviously, when we deal our report, we'll also deal with the conditions that we as Parliament would expect from all these interventions that we are making as recapitalization of the SOEs. Okay, I think that takes care of National Treasury. Thank you very much, Team National Treasury. When are we seeing you again, Mampo?
Chairperson, I think it's okay. The 13th or the 14th of March, but I'll be seeing you very soon.
And it has
to be physical now, Dr. Mampo, physical.
You hear the other members are missing you. So let's we'll talk to that. Where were you yesterday when you met with the minister?
Sorry, Chair, that one was above my pay grade.
Okay, but thank you very much, colleagues. Darren, I think our next agenda item is the approval of minutes. Which were sent to us. Let's see which dates are we looking at. Darren?
Chairperson, yes, we are looking at the minutes of the 15th, 17th, and 23rd of February.
Okay. Honourable members, can I place before you the minutes of the 15th of Feb for approval? Do I have a mover and a seconder?
Matafa moves, Chair.
Less than a second, Chair President.
Thank you. Thank you, honorable members. The minutes of the 15th of Feb actually adopted. Minutes of the 17th of Feb.
Mlezana moves.
Honorable
Mare second.
Honorable Mare second. Good day, Honorable Mare.
Thank you, sir.
The minutes of the 17th of February, Julie, adopted. Minutes of the 23rd, honorable members.
Kaiso moves.
Honorable Kaiso moves for the adoption of the minutes of the 23rd, seconda.
Matafa seconds.
Honorable Matafa seconds. The minutes of the 23rd of February should be adopted. Thank you, honorable members. Any announcements at Darren?
Chairperson, our next meeting will be next week, the 7th of March, where the FFC will be briefing the committee on the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill, as well as the 2023 Second Adjustments Appropriation Bill. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Darren. Our members, this takes us to the end of the meeting. And thank you very much. Speedy recovery.